Episode 168, interview with Alison Armstrong on the Queen's Code audiobook release. Welcome to How to Glow, where we get real about building the marriage of your dreams. I'm certified coach Kayla Levin, and I help married Jewish women go from surviving and overwhelmed to thriving and connected through practical tips, real life inspiration, and more than a little self-awareness along the way. Hello, my friends. I have Alison Armstrong back for the third time on the podcast. So if it's not obvious that I love her material, it should be now. You're not paying attention. It's not obvious anymore. Alison Armstrong is a teacher, an educator who has studied and researched men and women for many years and has a very compelling way of teaching paradigms to help you understand each other better. I discovered Alison when I was 6 years married, and I found her work to give me a lot of really helpful paradigm shifts in terms of understanding my husband and his motivations and what were the common stumbling blocks we were coming up against. She's written a few books. The Queen's Code, which is the one we're talking about today, is a romantic novel that conveys the wisdom about men and women that Alison is best known for in a compelling story format. And she recently turned it into an audiobook with herself as the narrator. So I hope you really enjoy this episode today. I do want to give you a heads up that, as with any work that I do, I'm leaving it in your hands to decide if hashkafically it's the right fit for you. I would say that Alison Armstrong's concepts are 100% Torah compatible. However, because it's in a story format, it's not always Beis Yaakov friendly. Let's just put it that way. Okay, so just giving everyone a heads up in case you want to check it out, look into it more, even send me a message if you're not sure if it's appropriate for you and your personal sensitivities. I'm very happy to help you make a decision about it, but you don't need my help. You can for sure figure it out for yourself. So enjoy the interview. She shares a lot of really helpful concepts and tips that we've got some good takeaways for you this week. So I know you're going to enjoy it. Alison Armstrong, it is such a pleasure to have you. This is the third time you have been on my podcast, so I feel super gifted for that. So thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome, and thanks for being how you are that I would want to come on. Personal.
I appreciate that. Thank you. We're talking today about the Queen's Code. Just to share a little bit for me is that I just went and looked at my Amazon orders. I ordered it in 2015, which means when I read it, I was about 6 years married, which I have to say was just enough time to have developed some of the problems that are addressed. And I feel so blessed to have gotten that material so early in my marriage, because I've spent, now we're married 13 years, and I feel that I have been able to delight in my husband in a way that I would not have had without you in my life.
Wow. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It's a very special work to me. So it came out 5 years earlier, and just put together some of the questions that I came up with listening to it again and rediscovering it. It's the kind of book that I keep on my shelf. But every time someone's over, I'm like, nudge, nudge. Maybe you want to read this. All my clients end up reading it usually.
Yeah. And was it different to listen to it?
It was. Yes, for sure. And I think the main thing for me was that I felt that you were in the room with me. It was almost like I said to my husband, I was like, it was like I had Alison there saying, I'm going to tell you the story that's going to help you. Your love for the people that are listening, I felt like came through. Maybe I'm imagining it, but I suspect not.
You didn't imagine. Yeah. It's true.
And so it really felt like almost supportive. I have a distinctive voice also, at least to me. So, you know, like you're very there at the same time, I'm able to get lost in the story. So it was like they're both things at the same time happening. Does that make any sense?
It does to me, because it happened to me. Like I say in the beginning of the book, I didn't write that book. Right. I watched the movie and I typed as fast as, and it still affects me the way it affects other people. There's so many parts I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember them. I'm reading them and going, that's in here. That's in here. And so, yeah, I get it. It's its own thing. It's magical.
Right.
And I feel really privileged that I got to be the one that watched the movie and typed as fast as I could. And then when I got to read it for the audiobook starting a year ago, there's times you can hear it in my voice. I would have to stop recording and the sound engineer would wait for me while I sobbed. just so affecting me.
As I was listening to it, I said to my husband, I don't think there's a certain part where there's like a big conflict between one of the characters and her husband. And I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to listen to it. I did manage to. I think one of the things about hearing it as an audiobook, at least for me, is that when I'm reading, I'm in a slightly different mode. So in terms of the material, it forced me to slow down. I think in a way, and pick up a little bit more nuances. I think that there's some main skills that the characters are explicitly learning, but of course there's so much sprinkled in between those skills, little things dropped as we go. And I felt like I was able to catch those a little bit better than when I read it. And also I think what's really very relevant to my audience is that sometimes it's just easier to listen than to read. If you're the type of person who listens to a podcast, right? Then if you want to get the content, and if it's not realistic, every time you lay down in bed to read your book, you're asleep before you get through the first page. So practically speaking, it's also a help.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, practically. And if I may, I was interviewed a few weeks ago by a woman in Cape Town, South Africa. And the thing she said to me, I don't know if I'll ever get over it, because she had read the book several years ago, right, in print. And she realized that the difference between her reading it to herself and hearing me read it is that the men's parts, right, there are four men in the Queen's Code, that she never read what they were saying with anywhere close to the emotion and sincerity and even intentionality that they have. And she realized it was because her prejudice against men, she never thought they could be that way. So she never read it that way. Yeah. That's and huge. Huge. And the four men in the Queen's Code, they're not extraordinary men. Mm-hmm. They're not like one in a million men. They are men. And they're just men being men and expressing themselves the way they will when they sense that expressing themselves will do good, that the person they're expressing themselves to doesn't mean them harm. So it's safe to express, and the risk will cause good to happen. And that's so much a part of who men are.
Explain that more. I'm not sure I'm completely understanding.
So if you think of men as warriors and hunters, right? So protectors and providers. And protecting trumps providing. It's a hierarchy, okay? Procreate trumps protect. This is why we have to teach safe sex. Every species risks its life to procreate, every species on the planet, flora and fauna. And then protect trumps provide. So we mostly want men to provide for us. But if they perceive a threat to us, then them protecting us from that threat. Honey, I know you want a new couch, but we don't have enough money in our savings account to get through a bad time if it lasts too long.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say no to the couch.
So he'll
veto providing in order to protect us. Well, then if he senses a threat to himself, then protecting himself, trumps providing for himself, trumps providing for somebody else. Protecting himself will carry the day. What's natural for men, their default relationship to communication is concealment. So they conceal anything that they think could be used against them, which means they're going to conceal what's important to them, because that could be used against them. They're going to conceal their attachments to people because they could be used against them. They're going to conceal their emotions because those could be used against them, and their feelings, which I distinguish between the two. They'll conceal just information. They'll conceal their plans. Anything that someone could foil or use to defeat them, their natural thing to do is to conceal it. Unless they think the person can't hurt them. This is how I learned so much sitting next to men on airplanes. I didn't know their name. I didn't know where they lived. They told me things that they're like, my wife doesn't even know this. They knew I could not hurt them. And then men who've allowed me to learn through them now for over 30 years, I've proven I won't hurt them.
Right.
I always ask, can I quote you anonymously if necessary? And they'll say, yes, anonymously is good. Or go ahead and use my name. I'll stand by that 24/7. But I'm always protecting them, and they know that I don't throw anything back in their face. And it's the same thing in an intimate relationship. A man will tell us what's going on with him, tell us what he's feeling, tell us when he's afraid or angry if we don't use it against them. But in most marriages, there's a history, and he'll remember the first time she spit something back at him, and that's it. They shut down. They're going to protect themselves first. And so they won't reveal anymore. So this is why, like, all four characters in the Queen's Code, that as the women are learning how to not interrupt so they can get their thoughts out, listening, and then they're listening to learn. They're listening for what's important to a man, even when he's not stating it clearly, because it's like a treasure hunt. It can't help but leak out. It leaks out, especially in their opinions. What's important to them gets, and they even know it. They'll even not tell someone their opinion about something because they know that's a kind of vulnerability. Mm. Very interesting. And so as the women are learning how to be a space where there isn't a right answer, there's true curiosity, which comes from the Greek to care, and they're not going to jump on something and throw it back in their face. And except for the time that Kimberly did and cleaned it up, right? So just the fact that she cleaned it up, whoa, that us cleaning things up earns trust. Us holding ourselves to account for a higher standard earns trust, right? And so as they're being trustworthy, all the men are expressing more and more. Like even Bert, how long he'll stay at the table to contribute to the conversation. Yes. And in this way, they're not like extraordinarily expressive men. They're just not. They're how expressive men are when it's safe to express themselves. And then on the other side of it, when they see that it did good, it made a difference, and it was appreciated, which is the feedback that they're getting. Right? In all those different contexts, right? Inside of a marriage and a family relationship, Kimberly and her grandfather,
the work environment,
Kimberly and her boss, all of those places. And that's what's one of the things I love about men. There's something about how they think and how they're put together and their definition of honor and where their actions come from. And sometimes they'll say, you know, I know you had a good reason for that. No, I was just an ass. They'll hold themselves accountable. But mostly there's this congruency, right? That they keep being the same in all these different environments. And it's one of the things that they look for in a woman. That what is what you get is one of their highest compliments for about a woman.
Interesting.
That we keep being congruent with what we say and what we do and our own, you know, if we say we're tired and we treat ourselves like we're tired and we'll take a nap, now when she says she's tired, that's believable. If she says she's tired and then stays up for 2 more hours, then tired means nothing, clearly. Mm-hmm. So they start ignoring, I'm tired.
But women are so adaptive, that's not natural for us. Between diffuse awareness and just our general adaptation to everything,
yes,
that's a skill for us to work on, but I think it's worthwhile, meaning we benefit so much from that as well.
Yeah, it's not natural for us, not at all. You're absolutely right. And so, it's a discipline, discipline to say what we mean and mean what we say, to create congruency. Even in the midst of, with diffuse awareness, we live in a state of distraction. Being congruent when you're being whipped around, do this, oh no, do me, no, me first. When our awareness is bringing that to us to set out to do something and actually do it. I remember Craig, when he learned about how hard it is to open the refrigerator when I'm hungry and end up eating, when he found out what happens instead, that the refrigerator ends up being clean. I found out that he like played a game within himself, that I would say I'm hungry and he'd look at the clock and see how long it took me to eat. And he thought it was funny. He didn't know I needed help. He didn't know what was happening in my mind. And then when he learned that I needed help, everything is yelling at me to do it. And then that's when he took on, and this was a long time. We'd been married for probably 20 years, when he said, well, could I make you breakfast? Which I did a girl thing. I thought, could he make me breakfast? Could he make it right? No, there's no way he's going to make it. So I said, no, I don't think so. He said, could I get the things out of the refrigerator? And I thinking, clever. Okay, how can he's so clever. I think, how can you blow that? Okay, so I need eggs, spinach, and vegetable broth from the refrigerator. Can I get you the pan? I need this pan. So that's how he prayed. He's like, first, then he got the pan. Then he got the eggs, the spinach, and the broth. Okay, everything's ready for you. And then he started watching. He's like, could I get certified in this to do it right? Could I, maybe? And okay, if he got it wrong, what's the worst that could happen? It just wouldn't taste that good. Okay. This is worse.
That's amazing.
And men don't know when they say, what can I do with it? We're thinking, what can you do? My way.
Exactly. I literally tell the women, I'm like, you have to visualize yourself taking the reins and handing them to him and letting go. Like, you want him to clean the kitchen? He gets to decide what that looks like. Just let it go. Like, you have to step back. But
thank you.
I wouldn't have that concept if I hadn't first got there from you. This reminds me a little bit, as you're playing out this story, that one of the things I really appreciate about going back through the Queen's Code again was how you take us through the full transformation, because it's a novel format as opposed to just, hey, here's some good ideas on how to relate to men. We get to start with what the situation is now. And it really is one of those things that once you see it, you can't forget it. Cause I have to remember.
Yes.
I don't spend a lot of time with people who talk like that to men, but for sure. And of course, like, I'm sure I slip up still all the time. But so in the beginning, the characters, before they understand about us not emasculating men and what that actually looks like and what it does to men, they're going and they're having their exploration. And as we're watching it, we're getting on board. We're becoming prepared for the material that they're going to be learning. So I really appreciated that. Were there any, I'm assuming that might've been a consideration, but in terms of your decision to initially make this into a novel as opposed to a nonfiction book.
Yes. And thanks for asking. I began in transformation when I was 19 years old. That's when I did my first transformational program, completely hooked, life ever since. And I noticed in those seminar settings that the person being interacted with was the last one to get it. And often they didn't even get it.
Yep.
So the hot seat is the hardest place to learn, because it seems like a threat and we've got to defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we can't learn when we're defending ourselves. So I notice I don't like self-help books when they're saying you, and right? Because I have the reaction of defending myself. So I knew that. And then I was trying to teach my sister-in-law something about her husband, about the stages of development, like we teach in Keys of the Kingdom. And I was trying to teach it, and she had no interest. And I knew her marriage was in trouble because she didn't know her husband had become a king. And I was trying to help. No, wouldn't listen at all. I switched to telling a story. I started telling her the story. It's called The Princess and the Swamp Rat. And all of a sudden she's paying attention. And the story didn't have anything to do with her, because it was a story about dating and she'd been married for decades, right? So she couldn't be about her. But all of a sudden, like, now she's paying attention. So that's when I knew it had to be fiction. And it also so hard for us as women to even get to the edge of what do I have to do with this that isn't what's wrong with me that this is happening. Women like, what's wrong with me that he doesn't love me enough to not do that? Like, that's where we flip to, or that he doesn't respect me enough. He doesn't care about me enough. Like they talk about in the Queen's Code. That's very different what's wrong with me than what's my part. What's my part of this? Without self-recrimination, without putting ourselves down, just what's my part? So that neutrality, that curiosity, instead of the condemnation, we pretty much listen. A man taught me early on, men listen accused. I think as women, we listen condemned. We are just accused. We're condemned. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to see other women, not us, struggling with all these different justifications for taking power away from men. They all have different reasons for doing it. Different reasons it seems like the right thing. Like Karen has this standard and isn't, what's wrong with having a high standard? And Kimberly has all this fear, right? And Melissa has all this anger and resentment, right? So they have different reasons for doing it, and getting to see through their eyes and how they're coming to terms with it, we get to do where the shoe fits, wear it, right? Nobody's pointing a finger at us.
Yep.
Our guard is down. Yeah. And we don't have, there's nothing to be on guard for, right? Listening to this story that, you know, has its own gravity to it, right? Mm-hmm. So easy to get caught up in. And I don't know if you know this, Kayla. You do know I didn't actually write it.
I've read what you've written about your experience writing it.
Yeah. I watched a movie and typed as fast as I could. And so, like, things like, tell me about the character development. I didn't right. develop them. They are, right? They showed me themselves over a period of about 6 weeks in their lives. And I got to get to know them just as when people are listening to the audiobook, you get to know them. And they're unfolding before the women in front of them. And the women are getting to see themselves and love themselves more and forgive themselves and hold themselves to, I'm better than this. Instead of some shame on you, you should be better than that. No, I am better than this and I want to be better than this for me.
So those questions don't work.
It's pretty
it
funny.
It just happens. You were a vessel. Funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do have one question about the characters though, but not necessarily your decision. Since it might not have been a decision, but what would you say, I guess, because I love that you have a single woman and a married woman. So we can see how this, and also one of them's a teacher and one of them works with men. So you're able to see all the different situations. However, the one with the kids is the one who is struggling the most. And I don't know that I connected to her objections, but I connected to her life situation. The other two women seem to have a lot of freedom. They had a lot of financial freedom and time freedom. So when they get into, oh, I need to go for a horseback ride or spend time on the beach, I'm like, okay, I got five kids and a nursing baby. Like, what's happening here? And I can imagine that other people would think that too, but I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask you, like, what would you say to women, how we can use the wisdom from the book when there might be financial constraints or time constraints, and we're trying to show up as the queen?
A great question. It's funny, I've never thought of the four women that way, the way you just articulated it. I just never did. So cool observation. So what you can hear in different ways, but from Bert, and from Jack and from Mike, not so much from Raul, is how much they are nurtured and benefit and enlivened by being paid attention to by women, and especially in such a positive, open way. Like, to be seen means so much to them. And as women, my assertion is that's, we are naturally life bringers, life force bringers. It flows through us, whether it's biological children or a smile, our life force flows through us. And we have a saying, where your consciousness goes, your life force flows. And that's why it diminishing to a man to be ignored. Like when, and they don't know that we'll not make eye contact because we're afraid they'll make it mean something. Like we won't make eye contact with a stranger because we're afraid they'll take it as an invitation to ask us for something. And they don't know that we have this crazy stuff that if you're attracted to me, that means I'm obligated. Mm-hmm. No, they're just attracted to you. Thank you. And no, I'm not engaging in that way. So that whole boundary receiving thing gets really messed up. So we'll ignore a man, not knowing that to him, it's, oh, I'm worthless. Mm-hmm. I'm not even worth noticing. I'm not even worth eye contact. I'm not even worth a hi or a smile. And it makes him angry. Like she thinks she's too good to even notice me. We don't know this is all going on. So there's a dynamic that creates a lot of stuff. And so if you go on the other side, if we're going to be these life givers, these life bringers, then the best way for us to be doing that is in a state of overflow, where we're not working to give energy. Our energy is overflowing because we filled ourselves up. And whether we fill ourselves up like Karen could with a horseback ride, to spend a couple hundred dollars to go, you know.
I mean, I'm not saying no. I'm just.
Yeah, no, Karen could do that. And, yeah. And Kimberly, do you know career woman Kimberly? She loves to drive her BMW and she loves to run on the beach. And she gets to live close enough to the beach to do that. But it's honestly anything that feeds us. I have a really modest lifestyle. I just do. But if you looked around, what feeds me is life. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. There are 14 plants I can see from where I'm sitting. About 6 of them are orchids, 2 of them in full bloom, 1 reblooming. You know, like sentimental things, cuttings that were given to me by a man who knew he was dying. He gave me cuttings of his plants. And so there's Pete, right? But it just to sit and be with them fills me up. I happen to have a horse and a donkey. I can't ride either one of them. They're not rideable. But just to touch them, just, right? But I pick up my own manure, right? I'm either shoveling it or tractoring it, right? I build my own electric fence. So I think all of us, we just need to search for the things that are, I would call them high octane or radioactive, do you know, that a little bit has a huge impact in renewing us.
You're right. I think one of the biggest things that fed me over the last month or so was just taking a walk with a friend. Didn't cost a penny. Yeah. At night after everyone was asleep and it wasn't hot outside and we just were outside and I got to talk and we walked a little longer than we said we were going to. That was our rebellion. Yeah. So it doesn't have to take all of that extra.
It doesn't.
Yeah. 100%.
It doesn't. And you know, talking, there's so many studies on how talking affects women and the serotonin that's released after half an hour of just getting to outflow.
Yeah.
And nobody has to remember what we said.
That's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I have another one for you. So
okay, thanks.
You're so confident in being able to say a statement like all men are providers. And we know you've done your homework, of course.
Yep.
Can we own that confidently? We have to leave room for exceptions. Like, how does this work in terms of, I find that sometimes when I'm working with women, they want to immediately switch the paradigm. It's more, I'm like that and he's like that. And usually I'll say, that's fine, but we can also just experiment. Like, just try both, try them on. Let's see. And it's not necessarily the same paradigms, but any paradigm like this. And anytime that there's generally, I'm not sure exactly how to articulate the question, but yeah, I guess that is. It's like, how confident can we be with saying, okay, we've learned from this book, men are providers, or men, like you said earlier, they put protection over providing, or they relate to sex differently than women do, right? Any of these things, how do we own it? Do we leave room for exception? Like, how, where's your stance on that?
The job or mandate I was fulfilling in writing the Queen's Code was to transform the way women relate to men. That was the first mandate. And as it took 15 years to be able to write it, there was so much I needed to learn first. And I didn't know I was going to get to watch a movie. Maybe I didn't have to learn any of it. I don't know. We'll never know. And now I'm pregnant with the sequel to The Queen's Code, and Keys of the Kingdom is the prequel that I wrote because I couldn't write the book. And so as I've been, I started out studying men because that's where I was having problems. And then men always wanted to talk to me about women. And they said things about women that I was like, I don't know any women like that. And it took a while for me to figure out they were describing femininity. And I was like 98% in a hunting, masculine, kick butt, produce results, be in charge mode, and had been for a long time at that point. I was 30 years old. And discovering these this other kinds of ways of being and forms of power and ways to influence instead of control that you could end up with even bigger results. And like, I was learning that, but still wasn't trying to learn anything about women. I was just learning about men. And then I saw that our graduates, which at the time were all women, that the men in their lives were bringing out the worst in them. Just like I had found out that I was bringing out the worst in men, men were bringing out the worst in these women who were trying so hard to no longer emasculate. And so that had me start thinking, okay, what do men need to know about women? And so all the stuff that I'd basically been unconsciously absorbing, I now, this contrast showed up and I could articulate it. And I don't really know how to describe it. I like, sometimes I think of it as my mind is a starry sky, and every little bit of information or observation is another point of light in the sky. And then when someone gives me a particular question, or there's a result somebody wants, or I see a problem, I look up into the sky and all of a sudden a constellation appears. Oh my God, that's connected to that. I didn't know. And every time I think, how come I didn't see that before? Every time, you know, I'm wrong that I didn't see it before. I'm human. So what happened is there's all the stuff I was discovering about men, and then reflecting and seeing all these things about women. And then as I started teaching more and more the contrast between men and women, I saw something before it. That before male and female, before testosterone and estrogen, which then as we get older, levels change. And so men get more like women and women get more like men, right, in our brains. I saw that before that distinction, there are human instincts. There are human instincts. And so procreate, trumping, protect, and protect, trumping, provide. That's true across the planet. And it's, women are the same. This is a way that men and women are the same. And young people, you can see creativity in a young person. You can see how creating something and then wanting to protect it. They knocked down my sandcastle. And then, why are you hitting him? He knocked down my sandcastle. Okay, this is a four-year-old enacting. Right? Or, mommy, come see my sandcastle. He created it, right? He's watching out. Can I leave for a moment to go get my mom? No one's going to destroy it. Mom, he wants to provide the joy of the sandcastle to his mom. Look what I made for you, right? Girls will do the same thing. Come home from school with the handprint in the clay. Happy Mother's Day, Mom. So we all do it. Women are providers as well. It's just, what are we providing? And what, as providers, what has us be compelled to provide? Like, men are more likely to be compelled to provide something that solves a problem for us. They give us advice to solve a problem. Yeah. And we can be that way too, right? If a woman spends a lot of time in the concrete result arena, she'll do that. But when we're not like that, our tendency is more going to be to want to provide an experience, yeah. to provide a feeling. How can I make you feel better? What can I do so you feel better? That's a provider, but it has a very different expression. Can you see it?
100%.
Yeah. And there's also this difference, because providing is part of our instincts, we'll even decide and provide. We'll decide what somebody needs and we'll force it on them. There's force in it. There's control in it. Here, you have to take this advice so we don't have this problem again. Versus, or here, eat your chicken soup.
You'll feel better.
You'll feel better. And I need you to feel better, damn it. Yeah. Is there anything you need from me? Is there any way I can help? Force versus offer versus a space. You want to come into my kitchen and I'll make you some tea? It's a space we're inviting into. And I think for each of us, whether biologically we're male or female, or whatever's going on in our brain, we have higher levels of testosterone or estrogen, just to name a couple. It's for each of us, and this is why I'm so passionate about honor yourself first or all is lost. For each of us to decide, what would be a privilege to provide? What could I provide without sacrificing my own well-being? Because my own well-being is a contribution to everyone. If I put my own well-being first, then I am not a pothole in the road of life for someone else to trip or to give someone a flat tire. Because when we're upset, when we're off balance, when we lack vitality, we're now a negative in the ledger. So we have to get ourselves to a place of, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. That's actually a high state. You think we're supposed to be great and wonderful all the time. Fine would be a miracle if everyone on the planet were just really fine. I'm not in need of anything in the moment, right? I'm fine. I'm at a good neutral for me. And then to take it just a step further to the, how can I overflow? And what do I want to overflow at? Right? Because we can overflow as different qualities and they all have a different impact. So yes, I can state unequivocally, men are providers. I would say the same thing. Women are providers. Human beings are providers. And we all are happy when the people around us are in a providing state of either offering, so a space, or being accountable. I got that. Like Dan said at the end of our road trip, he was filling up the gas, hit the gas again. And it had started at the beginning with, oh, I hate the stinky part. Would you do it? He said, it's stinky to me too. Would you please do it anyway? At the end of the trip, I'd had enough consistency in how much I appreciated it that he just said, I got it. This is just mine. So he became accountable for pumping the gas. So it went from a way that I asked him to help me to something he said, I got this. This is my job. And that is a beautiful gift. Accountability is a beautiful gift. Yeah. As long as, again, it's not forced, that someone's being accountable for something that it would be a gift to us for them to be accountable instead of, why are you trying to take what's mine? Very complicated.
I think that's a wonderful thing to percolate though for this audience is like, what do we want to be overflowing with? The imagery I always give is like the mom, because a lot of my women have a lot of kids, is yes. Can you be the happy charging station? Like, this is how I imagine myself. I'm on the couch, like nothing's really happening. And they just like gravitate over, recharge, mm-hmm. run off back to their life. That's how I know I'm doing it. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, but just having that, and that also gives us back that individuality of each of us is going to overflow in a slightly different way. And mm-hmm. what is it that we want to be providing? It's very cool. I could go on, like what you just said, fired so many neurons for me. I could go on forever, but I have to ask you one last question before we lose time.
Just before you do though, I want you to say those two things are worth going on forever about: overflowing and countability. They're worth the I. And it's even something that you can ask, honey, what would be a gift to you if I were countable for it? And can I tell you the things that are a gift to me that you're countable for? And then that leads to, is there something you, if I were countable for that, it would be a gift. And so you're interacting at the level of gift instead of supposed to changes everything. And then even the concept of overflowing, instead of trying to be patient when you're fresh out of. So just thank you for calling those out, because literally someone could spend a couple of years just on those two things and life would be amazing.
Okay. More takeaways.
What did you want to ask?
So what's come up a little bit recently is there's a lot of middle prints in my community. I think my husband personally, I think, is racing to try and be your first king, like youngest king crowned. He's just like racing through the stages. I don't know if you've had a 36-year-old, if that would be your, I think you said late 30s for someone.
34.
Oh, he's already missed it.
was 34, but he was... I knew him in high school and he was so earnest, even in high school. Yeah.
Anyway, so I just have to ask if you have plans for Keys to the Kingdom to also become an audiobook.
Keys to the Kingdom is an audiobook.
No, it's not.
Yes.
Okay, great. I know what I'm doing next.
Yeah, Keys to the Kingdom, the audiobook, is now available on the Allison Armstrong mobile app.
Okay,
and it's been on Audible, I think, since 2012. It's consistently in the top 10% of audiobooks that are sold there. Yeah, Keys the Key. And it's why people waited so long for Queen's Code to be on audio. And yeah, it's there.
Wonderful. Okay, so we've got...
My voice was higher then when I recorded it. But I won't let anybody else record these because no one else watched the movie. Those were both movies that came through.
Amazing. All right. We hopefully we'll have lots of people who get an opportunity to listen to now both. And anything else you want to share about that? I know that there's more to just the audiobook. There's the app you just mentioned. Anything you want to specifically direct people to?
Yeah. The Queen's Code is only on our app. You can't get it on Audible. And there are a whole bunch more things that are going to show up on the app. And I'm also doing something called Your Queen's Code Journey, which I plan to keep doing because the book is so intense and you're learning in 10 hours the distillation of what I learned in 20 years. So it's mind-boggling in some ways. So I answer questions of people at chapter by chapter as they're listening to the book. So I just finished one whole batch of that. And the best of that is being edited into the next Your Queen's Code Journey. So people participating in the second one, I call it J2, the people participating in the second journey get the best of the first journey. Mm-hmm. And that'll just keep happening as a way to help people understand and absorb and implement. And one of the things that we do in the journey is you get to customize the vow for yourself. You get to create your own code of honor, not only the way that Claudia states it in the Queen's Code.
Very cool. All right. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on and sharing this with us.
Oh, thank you. And Kayla, thank you so much for how many people you help and pass it along. My goal's never been to be a best-selling author. It's been to be best read or even best pirated. And so for you to learn and turn around and teach and provide in your own words, it's charming the way that you put things.
Thank you.
I love it. I really love it. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's always such a pleasure.
Mwah.
Great to see you.
Bye, Kayla.
Okay, bye-bye. Hey there. If you know a newlywed, or you are one, we have a wedding gift for you. Go to kaylalevin.com/newlywed to get access to my best-selling course, First Year Married. You have got to be in your first 6 months, so make sure you don't wait. And if you've been married longer than that, but you're looking for some more support, or this stuff is just super fun for you, I'd love to have you join me inside of my membership community, How to Glow. It's for women looking for a fresh take on relationship development. Join us for live coaching calls, signature classes, and anonymous Q&A. Let's do it.